Hello, this is your volunteer broadcaster, Cicely Tiernan, bringing you the April 22nd, 2024 edition of the New Yorker magazine. Today's main story is, what is noise? Annals of sound, what is noise? Sometimes we embrace it, sometimes we hate it, and everything depends on who is making it. By Alex Ross. Noise is a fuzzy word, a noisy one, in the statistical sense. Its meanings run the gamut from the negative to the positive, from the overpowering to the mysterious, from anarchy to sublimity. The negative seems to lie at the root. Etymologists trace the word to nuisance and nausea. Noise is what drives us mad. It sends the Grinch over the edge at Christmas time. Oh, the noise, 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 noise. Noise is the sound of madness itself, the din within our minds. The demented narrator of Poe's The Telltale Heart jabbers about noise while he hallucinates his victim's heartbeat. I found that the noise was not within my ears. The noise steadily increased. The noise steadily increased. Yet noise can be righteous and majestic. The Psalms are full of joyful noise, noise unto the Lord. In the book of Ezekiel, the voice of God is said to be like the noise of many waters. In Paradise Lost, heaven makes infernal noise as it beats back the armies of hell. Public enemies bring the noise, marshals forces for a different kind of battle. At the same time, the word can summon all manner of gentler murmurs. The aisle is full of noises, sounds, and sweet air. Tennyson speaks of a noise of hymns. Coleridge of a noise like a hidden brook. In Elizabethan England, a noise could be a musical ensemble such as the one that supplied a heavenly melody for Queen Elizabeth's the first coronation pageant. Any hope of limiting the scope of the term evaporated when information theorists detached it from the acoustics altogether and applied it to any ambient activity that hinders a signal. Noise has come to mean an engulfing barrage of data, less an event than a condition. Other languages handle noise a bit less vaguely. In French, the most common term is bruit, which comes from the Latin for roar. That's a straightforward description of what a noise sounds like, as opposed to a subjective assessment of how it might upset us. In German, Lärm tends to indicate louder noises, Garrosh, softer, more natural ones. Russians have a range of words, including shum, which according to Vladimir Nabokov, suggests more of a swoosh than a racket. When Osip Mandelstam wrote of shum vremi, the noise of time, he captured an essential texture of modern life. Noise is capacious enough to have inspired a small and ever-growing library. Alongside various cultural histories, Bart Koso's Noise, David Hendy's Noise, Mike Goldsmith's Discord, The Story of Noise, Hillel Schwartz's 900-page Making Noise, you can read accounts of noise music scenes, Japanois, New York Noise, a noise-based literary criticism, Shakespeare's Noise, Kafka and Noise, and Philosophies of Noise. Epistemology of noise. Noise matters toward an ontology of noise. Not to mention practical-minded guides to reducing noise from your HVAC unit or reducing the noise in your head. How noise relates to music is as much a brooded topic in itself. Samuel Johnson offers an elegant resolution. Of all noises, I think music the least disagreeable. Music is our name for the noise that we like. With a universal definition hovering out of reach, the discourse concerning noise often starts with the personal. My history with the thing is fraught. I hate it and I love it. As a child, I was extraordinarily sensitive to loud sounds. Family expeditions to 4th of July fireworks displays or steam railway museums routinely ended with me running in tears to the safety of the car. When in early adulthood, I moved into the noise cauldron of New York City, I was tormented by neighbor stereos and by the rumble of the street. I stuffed windows with pillows and insulation. I invested in industrial-strength earplugs. I positioned an oversized window fan next to my bed. This neurosis has subsided, but I remain that maddening hotel guest who switches rooms until he finds one that overlooks an air shaft or an empty lot. All the while, I was drawn to music that others would pay money to avoid. Having grown up with classical music, I found my way to the refined bedlam of the 20th century avant-garde. Edgar Varèse, John Cage, Karlheinz Stockhausen, Giorgi Ligeti. In college, I hosted a widely unheard radio station on which I broadcast things like Ligeti's Poème Symphonique, a piece for 100 metronomes. When someone called in to report that the station's signal had gone down, I protested that we were in fact listening to music. Similar misunderstandings arose when I aired Cage's Imaginary Landscape No. 4 for 12 radios. When I moved on to so-called popular music, I had ears only for the churning dissonance of Cecil Taylor, AMM, and Sonic Youth. I became a keyboardist in a noise band, which made one proudly chaotic public appearance in 1991. At one point, my bandmates and I improvised over a tape loop of the minatory opening chords of Richard Strauss's Die Frau und Schatten. Obviously, my issues with noise pivot on the question of control. When the noise occurs on my own terms, I enjoy it. When it's imposed on me, I recoil. The bifurcation is typical, even if I represent an extreme case. Garrett Kanzer, in his incisive 2010 book, The Unwanted Sound of Everything We Want, a book about noise, observes that the noise-music distinction is ultimately an ethical one. If you elect to hear something, it is not noise, even if most people might deem it unspeakably horrible. If you are forced to hear something, it is noise, even if most people might deem it ineffably gorgeous. Thus Kaiser writes, Lou Reed's metal machine music performed at the Gramercy is not noise. Gregorian chant piercing my bathroom walls is. Unwanted sound is the basic definition. An act of aggression is implied. Someone is exercising power by projecting sound into your space. Sometimes the act is unconscious. People don't realize how loud their speakers are, or they assume that everyone loves their music as much as they do. Sometimes, though, it is a gesture of undisguised brutality. Late one night in 2022, I asked some frat boyish neighbors to turn down their thumping techno. They responded it by turning it up. When I complained again, one of them began shouting, "Fucking faggot," and hurling his body against my door. I lack the presence of mind to remark upon the irony of homophobes blasting techno in Chelsea, of all places. We seldom reject the sounds of people we like. Dispute over noise expose social fissures. The classic cinematic study of noise, music, noise, and violence is Spike Lee's Do the Right Thing, in which Radio Raheem brings his boombox inside Sal's pizzeria, blaring Public Enemy's Fight the Power. Sal says, "What did I tell you about that noise?" Radio Raheem protests, "This is music, my music." Minutes later, he is dead, the victim of a police killing. The perception of hip-hop as black noise, the title of a 1994 book by the pop culture scholar Trisha Rose, is part of a long history of sonic dehumanization directed at minority groups. The word barbarian originates from a disparaging Greek term, barbaros, which appears to evoke the alleged gibberish of foreign peoples, bar, bar, bar. The musicologist Ruth Hakon has tracked long-standing European perceptions of Jews as a spectacularly noisy people, larmwe an inner jordanshua, or noise as in a synagogue, remained a popular German expression into the Nazi period. Mandelstam inverts those perceptions in The Noise of Time, relishing the intricacy of Jewish chaos. Colonizers who disdained the weird sounds of native peoples overlook the fact that they themselves were causing unprecedented levels of commotion. Bells, trumpets, guns, cannons, machines. Noise enables power. As Kaiser writes, it is a way of saying, the world is mine. Amid the hubbub of urban life, silence is the luxury of the rich. They can afford the full-floor penthouse apartment, the house that sits on a quiet acre. They can install triple-paned windows and pump insulation into the walls. They can, if they choose, become Proust in his cork-lined room. For the rest of society, noise is an index of struggle. Hendy's Noise, which is based on a 2013 BBC radio series, documents the ruckus of tenement living in 18th century Edinburgh and the altogether hellish clamor inflicted on iron workers in 19th century Glasgow. A doctor wrote of a group of Glasgow boilermakers, "The iron on which they stand is vibrating intensely under the blows of perhaps 20 hammers wielded by 20 powerful men. Confined by the walls of the boiler, the waves of sound are vastly intensified and striking the tympanum with appalling force." The colossal cacophony of the Industrial Revolution prompted some of the first serious efforts at noise control. Often these amounted to crabby elitism. Charles Babbage lamented the organ grinders and other similar nuisances who were degrading the productivity of intellectual workers. Charles Dickens signed a letter claiming that writers and artists had become an especial objects of persecution by brazen performers on brazen instruments. But the New York anti-noise activist Julia Barnett Rice, who founded the Society for the Suppression of Unnecessary Noise in 1906, transcended upper crust narcissism by arguing that people of all backgrounds were suffering from excessive noise in schools and hospitals. She intuited what scientific studies later confirm, that noise can inhibit learning and complicate health issues. It can also, of course, cause auditory damage in the form of tinnitus and hearing loss. Attempts to mitigate and legislate noise levels run up against the challenge of adjudicating which sounds are excessive and unpleasant. Measuring loudness is itself a tricky business. The decibel scale, like the Richter scale, is logarithmic, and it accounts for quirky neural responses to changing stimuli. A 20 decibel sound is generally perceived as being twice as loud as a 10 decibel one, yet the actual intensity is 10 times greater. Furthermore, the decibel scale is customarily weighted to factor in additional peculiarities. We are more sensitive to upper frequencies. A soprano is more conspicuous than a bass, to indoor sounds, to nighttime sounds. With all these complexities, noise codes, where they exist, are difficult to enforce. In 2022, the New York City's Department of Environmental Protection received nearly 50,000 complaints, but imposed monetary penalties in only 123 instances. Emergency warnings, foghorns, locomotive whistles, ambulance and fire truck sirens, air raid sirens fall into a special category of necessary life-saving noise. Car horns are a borderline case. Sometimes they stave off disaster, but more often they foster road rage. Matthew F. Jordan's Danger Sound Klaxon, The Horn That Changed History, studies one of the most purposely obnoxious noises of modern times, the ah-oh-ga honk that became ubiquitous on American roads in the early 20th century. In a free-for-all traffic environment, drivers alerted pedestrians and other vehicles, operators, by using the horn incessantly. Ads for the klaxon, invented by the electrical engineer Miller Reese Hutchinson and introduced in 1907, boasted of its ability to cut through and kill musical sounds. Raw panic was the aim. During the First World War, the klaxon was used to warn of gas attacks. It then declined in popularity, partly because traumatized veterans reacted poorly to its squawk. We humans have a high tolerance for noise, despite our ambivalence. In some ways, we seem to require it. Other species feel differently about the never-ending sonic havoc of the Anthropocene. Caspar Henderson, in A Book of Noises, notes on the Araucous, points out that when our species stayed mostly indoors during the early months of the COVID pandemic, the animal world reacted with apparent relief. Birdsongs regained qualities that had been recorded decades before when cities were quieter. The white-crowned sparrows, for instance, extended their sounds back down into lower frequencies, and their songs became richer, fuller, and more complex. Birds also sang more softly. They had been shouting, just as people raise their voices on a construction site or at a noisy party. Their stress levels likely declined. Noise is another dimension of humanity's ruination of the public of the natural world. The inexorable advance of technological noise in the 20th century, cars, airplanes, helicopters, pile drivers, lawnmowers, leaf blowers, home stereos, stadium sound systems, left the impression that the world was getting louder year by year. This may have well been so, but in recent decades, there has actually been a leveling off or even a decline in certain types of noise. Jet engines are less thunderous than they were in the 70s. The increasing popularity of electric vehicles has brought about a situation in which cars can be dangerously inaudible to pedestrians. Artificial engine noise has become a feature of electric models. People now routinely listen to music on laptops and headphones, reducing incursions of bass. These modest gains are offset by the rise of informational noise, which further blurs the meaning of the already confused parent word. Chenpeng Yang's Transforming Noise, A History of Its Science and the Technology from Disturbing Sounds to Informational Errors, 1900 to 1955, is thick with mathematical equations, yet it still shows an interesting story even for those of us who will skip the more technical pages. Beneath the vehicular roar and the years around 1900 was a simmering new electronic sound native to the telephone, the phonograph, the radio, and other forms of transmission and reproduction. Yang describes this noise as disturbances and fluctuations of electrical current due to the movements of microscopic charge carriers in electronic tubes and other circuit compounds. Such sounds weren't aggressively unpleasant, yet they hampered the communication of messages, verbal or musical. Scientists and engineers set about studying this electronic sizzle and figuring out how to reduce it. The investigation soon intersected with ongoing inquiries into the movement of gas and liquid particles. Einstein's papers on Brownian motion between 1905 and 1908 not only established the existence of atoms, they also helped to systematize the discipline of statistical mechanics, which describes patterns of random fluctuations over time, also known as stochastic processes. Defense during the Second World War adapted those insights to military ends, devising uncrackable cryptography, resisting signal jamming, reducing interference in anti-aircraft radar systems. Claude Shannon, the founder of information theory, took an even more significant step by demonstrating how a signal can cope with a noisy channel, literally or figuratively, if it behaves in a noisy, stochastic way by spreading itself across a broad spectrum. It transmits more effectively. That insight underpins modern cellular and wireless communications. It was a curious extension of the logic of the klaxon. In a world full of noise, you punch through by making noise at a superior level. Soon enough, the concept of stochastic noise, often simplified to the point of vanishing, achieved currency in a dizzying array of fields. Noise studies of recent decades examine perturbations in the stock market. The Economist Fisher Black's paper Noise, Unreliable Patterns in Decision-Making, Daniel Kahneman, Oliver Sibony, and Cass Sunstein's Noise, A Flaw in the Human Judgment, and Irregularities in Political Polling, Nate Silver's The Signal and the Noise. The proposed corrective for such errancy is very often the dreaded algorithm. Kahneman and his company argued that algorithms, being noise-free, can outperform human judgment. Machine learning protocols and artificial intelligence, meanwhile, rely heavily on stochastic processes. The ultimate import of much of this work is that humans are themselves randomly fluctuating particles whose behavior in aggregate can be forecast by probabilistic methods. Yang helps out the mathematically illiterate. Offering a literary frame for noise's semantic shift. In his introduction, he juxtaposes a 19th century account of invasive sound, Nathaniel Hawthorne's dismayed reaction to a train whistle, with the Reagan-era data escape of Don DeLillo's White Noise, with its swarm of words, pictures, numbers, facts, graphics, statistics, specs, waves, particles, motes. White Noise is a sound field in which all frequencies are equally intense. When the married couple at the novel's center, Babette and Jack, have a conversation about death, the crack of doom becomes a wash of static. What if death is nothing but sound, electrical noise? You hear forever, sound all around. How awful. Uniform, white. White noise is the master noise in which all other noises drown. The perpetual swirl of cultural particles mutes the resonance of any individual voice. The irony is that the atomized buzz common to so much late 20th century technology, fax machines, dial-up modems, the hiss between stations on a radio dial, the poltergeist snow of a TV left on overnight, has largely faded. Such noise now resides in our minds as we fend off notifications, updates, just-for-you suggestions, consumer feedback requests, obscene spam, clickbait headlines, AI-generated news stories, AI-generated news stories about AI, and the whole silently screaming rest of it. From time to time, nature unleashes a noise so immense that it restores the biblical grandeur of the world. Many books on noise mention the Indonesian volcano Krakatoa, which, in August 1883, disgorge what is commonly called the loudest sound in modern history. The eruption was audible from as far away as 3,000 miles. The captain of a British ship that was 40 miles distant wrote, "So violent are the explosions that the eardrums of over half my crew have been shattered. My last thoughts are, my dear wife, I am convinced that the day of judgment has come." In October, I went to the Brooklyn Experimental Music Venue Issue Project Room to hear Virtual Oral Electromechanics, a 50-minute-long audio collage by the sound artist Francisco Lopez. The performance space, a cavernous Beaux-Arts gallery that McKim, Mead, and White had originally designed for the Elks organization, was plunged into darkness. Attendees were given masks to cover their eyes. In a program note, Lopez writes, "This creation was developed from a myriad of original sound recordings of mechanical machines, electromechanical systems, and industrial environments gathered over the past 25 years all over the world, from food factories to white rooms, from 18th century automata to computers, from wood and wires to magnetism, from the microscopic to the monumental. If you demand that music provides an oasis of melodious sweetness, Virtual Oral Electromagnetics would not be for you. It is an experience of overwhelming density. Loudness is not the chief characteristic. Any average rock show or dance club would outdo it in decibels, but it covers such a vast range of frequencies and timbres, from lung-shaking bass tones to a tintinnabulation in stratospheric registers, that the brain struggles to assimilate the entirety of it. I imagine phantom structures in the air. The sound was bleeding into my other senses. Is virtual oral electronomechanics music? In the usual sense, no. The Oxford English Dictionary associates music with beauty of form, harmony, melody, rhythm, expressive content, etc., implicitly excluding machines and food factories. The great German physicist Hermann von Helmholtz in his 1863 tome On the Sensations of Tone, frames music as the opposite of noise. A musical tone, Helmholtz writes, is a perfectly undisturbed, uniform sound. Noise is a jumble of rapid, irregular signals. Certain combinations of tones are more pleasing than others on account of physiological principles that Helmholtz charts in extraordinary detail. European composers have perfected the art of harmony, creating, it would appear, a bulwark against music, against noise. In the same period, though, composers began to have different ideas. Like birds, they were listening to the world around them and mimicking its increasingly raucous character. In Wagner's Der Rheinhold, the subterranean smithy of the Nieblings is evoked by a percussion section that includes, according to the score, 18 anvils. For a few bars, the orchestra stops playing and the anvils hammer away on their own, industry incarnate. Harmony, meanwhile, was drifting from its tonal moorings, a fearsome dissonance in the music of Mahler, Strauss, and the Scriabin suggested both the outer density of modern life and the inner turmoil of the individual. Mahler said, "If we want thousands to hear us in the huge auditorium of our concert halls and opera houses, we simply have to make a lot of noise, alarm." Matters came to a head in 1913. The brutish chords that stomped through the second section of Stravinsky's Rite of Spring packed 7 of the 12 notes of the Western chromatic scale into a confined space. As a result, pitch becomes a blur. T.S. Eliot later wrote that the rite seemed to transform the rhythm of the steps into the scream of the motor horn, the rattle of machinery, the grind of wheels, the beating of iron and steel, and the roar of the underground railway, to transform these despairing noises into music. On March 31st, 1913, 2 months before the premiere of The Rite, a concert in Vienna featuring works by Arnold Schoenberg and his circle let loose in an even more disturbing sound. In Alban Berg's orchestral song Über die Grenzen des Alls, or Beyond the Limits of the Universe, the winds and the brass intone a soft, unearthly sonority in which all 12 pitches are heard. This is an instrumental approximation of white noise, long before the term had been coined. The concert promptly devolved into a riot, one that even the famous uproar around the Rite could not equal. Fisticuffs broke out, the police were called, and a lawsuit ensued. In the same year of discord and scandal, the futurist painter Luigi Russolo published a manifesto titled L'Art de Rumore, The Art of Noises, in which he wrote, "For years, Beethoven and Wagner have deliciously shaken our hearts. Now we are fed up with them. This is why we get infinitely more pleasure imagining combinations of the sounds of trolleys, autos, and other vehicles, and loud crowds." To that end, Russolo and his brother Antonio devised a battery of homemade noise instruments. A recording from 1912 suggests a cafe band tootling away in a room with bad plumbing. Other composers made more persuasive ventures. Solo percussion works by Amadeo Roldan and Edgar Varese, early electronic experiments by Paul Hindemith and Oscar Sala, noise collages by the young John Cage, Varese's mammoth orchestral piece, MRX, which descended on Carnegie Hall in 1926, conjures the full pandemonium of the metropolis, with the New York Fire Department's siren filling out the orchestra. George Antheil and his Ballet Mécanique, which arrived at Carnegie the following year, called for airplane propellers whirring on stage, though he had to settle for electric fans. As Jing notes in Transforming Noise, Antheil played a cameo role in the evolution of stoicastic research. During the Second World War, he assisted the Hollywood star Hedy Lamarr, an Austrian emigre with a mathematical gift, in designing a frequency-hopping technology that would have prevented the jamming of torpedo guidance systems. Nothing immediately came of the Lamar and Thiel scheme, though it forecast later breakthroughs. After the war, the engineer-turned-composer Ioannis Exarchakis transformed stochastic process into musical language. You're listening to the New Yorker Magazine on Sun Sounds of Arizona, read by your volunteer broadcaster, Cicely Tiernan. The instrumental lines of his 1955-56 score, Pithopraca, are explicitly modeled on Brownian motion. Ligeti's Poem Symphatique from 1962 does something analogous. At first, the 100 metronomes generate a uniform cloud of indistinguishable tick-tocks. Then, as one device after another winds down, the remaining voices become audible. In performance, the poem begins as a comedy and ends as a tragedy, an emblem of a dying ecosystem. Noise enriched popular music, too. Jazz musicians extending the blues tradition activated pitches outside the standard 12-note gamut. The siren-like sneer from the trombone glissando became a signature sound. Jazz not only cut through the crackle of surface noise, but also thrived on it. The emergence of a full-blown jazz avant-garde after the Second World War brought musical modernism to an exuberant peak. Rock entered its noise art phase in the 70s and 80s with the industrial grind of such bands as Throbbing Gristle and Essenstrunnen Neubauten. Hip-hop manipulated noise from the onset. Hank Shockley, Public Enemy's master producer, echoed the rhetoric of Varese and Cage when he said, "We believe that music is nothing but organized noise. You can take anything, street sounds, us talking, whatever you want, and make it music by organizing it. This thing you called music is a lot broader than you think it is." Supreme among noisemakers is Yoko Ono, who first made her name as a principled provocateur in the downtown New York scene. Next to her, Cage looked timid, and then shot to global fame through her relationship with John Lennon. Her furiously nuanced screaming of the word "why" at the beginning of Yoko Ono, Plastic Ono Band from 1970 was a masterly act of one-upmanship in the face of the masculinist assault of mainstream rock and roll. Beatles fans confronted with the noise of a higher order were as aghast as the socialite aristocrats who booed the Rite of Spring. Noise is only one part of Ono's mercurial practice. She was equally drawn to meditative gentleness, but she deserves a central place in the histories of the genre. For the most part, she has been left out of them. Implicit in the art of noise is a promise of resistance. For millennia, music has been a medium of control. Noise, it follows, is a liberation. Schoenberg went so far as to speak of the emancipation of dissonance, making his harmonic innovations sound like a civil rights matter. The social theorist Jacques Attali, in his 1977 book, Noise, the Political Economy of Music, put a sophisticated spin on that argument. The bruit nouveau that Attali hears emerging from free jazz and the European avant-garde has a revolutionary import. It denies the marketplace. It refuses popular taste. It involves inventing new codes and playing for one's own pleasure. Subsequent treatises, such as Paul Hegarty's Noise Music, have maintained Helmholtz's duality while reversing its biases so that noise heroically destroys music's stifling banalities. The question is, resistance to what? Nothing about noisemaking guarantees personal or political virtue. Russolo, like many other members of the futurist movement, found a way to reconcile his bourgeois bashing ideas with fascist aesthetics. Varese was tainted by racism and anti-Semitism. In more recent decades, Nazi iconography and vocabulary have adorned noise records by Whitehouse and Boyd Rice. The magisterial Japanese noise artist Masamo Akiri, who has released hundreds of implacably obliterative recordings under the name Mare's Bow, has shown self-awareness about his mentality of domination. Sometimes I would like to kill the much too noisy Japanese by my own noise, he has said. The effect of Japanese culture are too much noise everywhere. I want to make silence by my noise. Maybe that is fascist way of using sound. Stephen Graham, who teaches courses on underground music at Goldsmiths in London, takes a different tack on becoming noise music, a survey of the field since the 70s. Aware of the murkiness surrounding the notion of resistance, Graham focuses instead on the genre's aesthetics. Furthermore, the opposition of noise and music dissatisfies him. The appeal of this grittiest of genres lies precisely in the erasure of the boundary between the two. There is no way of talking about noise without taking pleasure into account. The pleasure may be confined to a niche audience, and perhaps a somewhat masochistic one, but exists all the same. No one chooses to listen to a sound because of what it is not. How do you articulate the aesthetics of a music that follows the logic of dumbfounding excess? Graham made a good stab in some pages devoted to Mirsbo's album, Noise Embryo, from 1994. He begins by observing somewhat dryly that the listener is confronted with a kind of chaotic order or musicality flickering into and out of existence as, say, a steady pulse pattern emerges, or an oscillating bass drone throbs into existence, or a panrhythm of clashing noise layers suddenly locks into polyrhythmic place. He then switches to stream of consciousness italics to convey the rush of surrender. I flow into the beating world, staying there as the music keeps changing and pulsing. It's possible to transcend trance in this way with more conventional music, but the low rate of repetition and high rate of density and strangeness in noise mean that such trancing can have a particularly rich, tensile quality when it's achieved. This music takes me out of myself and makes me cosmic. Such effusions are a bit embarrassing to read, but any critic who wishes to capture pleasure must embarrass the reader sooner or later. I experience similar to Graham's when I lose myself in exemplary spells of musical noise, whether it's Mirsbo, Ono, the apocalyptic war scene in Chaza Chernowin's opera Infinite Now, or the Krakatoan subwoofer frequencies of Ashfior's installation Hive Rise. The thrill I get from such sounds doesn't contradict my abiding love for Bach, Schubert, and Brahms any more than the abstract frenzy of a Jackson Pollock contradicts the radiant calm of Fra Angelico. What I love about noise is its insistence on otherness, on difference. If music was ever to become a universal language, it would be dead. As for Lopez's virtual oral electromagnetics, it left me in a state of happy vacancy, as if the digital detritus in my brain had been swept away. Yet I had been engaged in active, alert listening. I'd been nodding and swaying in time even when no beat was apparent. The colliding pulses seemed to coalesce into a fundamental ghost rhythm that was as insistent as any pounding bass. The mind is its own place, as Milton's Lucifer says. It can establish its own order, its own harmony. I walked down into the streets of Brooklyn feeling alive, serene, particularly free. When I entered the screech of the subway, though, I winced and put on noise-canceling headphones. Alex Ross has been the magazine's music critic since 1996. His latest book is Wagnerism, Art and Politics in the Shadow of Music. A critic at large, don't believe what they're telling you about misinformation. People may fervently espouse symbolic beliefs, cognitive scientists say, but they don't treat them with the same as factual beliefs. It's worth keeping track of the difference. By Manveer Singh. Millions of people have watched Mike Hughes die. It happened on February 22, 2020, not far from Highway 247 near the Mojave Desert city of Barstow, California. A homemade rocket ship with Hughes strapped in it took off from a launching pad mounted on a truck. A trail of steam billowed behind the rocket as it swerved and then shot upward, a detached parachute unfurling ominously in its wake. In a video record recorded by the journalist Justin Chapman, Hughes disappeared into the sky, a dark pinpoint in a vast, uncaring blueness. But then the rocket reappeared and hurtles toward the ground, crashing after 10 long seconds in a dusty cloud half a mile away. Hughes was among the best-known proponents of flat Earth theory, which insists that our planet is not spherical but a frisbee-like disk. He had built and flown in two rockets before, one in 2014 and another in 2018, and he planned to construct a raccoon, a combination rocket and balloon, that would carry him above the upper atmosphere where he could see the Earth's flatness for himself. In the 2020 takeoff, staged for the Science Channel series Homemade Astronauts, was supposed to take him a mile up, not high enough to see the Earth's curvature, but hype-worthy enough to garner more funding and attention. Flat Earth theory may sound like one of those deliberately far-fetched satires, akin to Burns Aren't Real, but it has become a cultic subject for anti-scientific conspiratorialists, growing entangled with movements such as QAnon and COVID-19 skepticism. And off the edge, flat earthers, conspiracy culture, and why people will believe anything, Algonquin. The former Daily Beast reporter, Kelly Wheel, writes about the tragedy awakened her to the sincerity of flat earthers' convictions. After investigating the flat earth scene and following Hughes, she had figured that on some subconscious level, Hugh knew that the earth wasn't flat. His death set her straight. I was wrong. Flat earthers are serious as your life. Wheel isn't the only one to fear the effects of false information. In January, the World Economic Forum released a report showing that 1,490 international experts rated misinformation and disinformation the leading global risk of the next 2 years, surpassing war, migration, and climatic catastrophe. A stack of new books echoes their concerns. And Falsehoods Fly, Why Misinformation Spreads and How to Stop It, Columbia. Paul Thagard, a philosopher at the University of Waterloo, writes that misinformation is threatening medicine, science, politics, social justice, and international relations, affecting problems such as vaccine hesitancy, climate change denial, conspiracy theories, claims of racial inferiority, and the Russian invasion of Ukraine. In Foolproof, Why Misinformation Infects Our Minds and How to Build Immunity, Sandra van der Linden, a social psychology professor at Cambridge, warns that viruses of the mind disseminated by false tweets and misleading headlines pose serious threats to the integrity of elections and democracies worldwide. Or as the MIT political scientist Adam J. Bernansky puts it in Political Rumors, Why We Accept Misinformation and How to Fight It, Princeton, a democracy where falsehoods run rampant can only result in dysfunction. Most Americans seem to agree with these theorists of human credulity. Following the 2020 presidential race, 60% thought that misinformation had a major impact on the outcome. And to judge from a recent survey, even more believe that artificial intelligence will exacerbate the problem in this year's contest. The Trump and the DeSantis campaigns both used deepfakes to sully their rivals. Although they justified the fabrications as transparent parodies, some experts anticipate a tsunami of misinformation. In the words of Oren Etzioni, a professor emeritus at the University of Washington and the first CEO of the Allen Institute for Artificial Intelligence, the ingredients are there, and I am completely terrified, he told the Associated Press. The fear of misinformation hinges on assumptions about human suggestibility. Misinformation, conspiracy theories, and other dangerous ideas latch onto the brain and insert themselves deep into our consciousness, van der Linden writes in Foolproof. They infiltrate our thoughts, feelings, and even our memories. Thagard puts it more plainly. People have a natural tendency to believe what they hear and read, which amounts to gullibility. But do the credulity theorists have the right account of what's going on? Folks like Mike Hughes aren't gullible in the sense that they'll believe anything. They seem to reject scientific consensus after all. Partisans of other well-known conspiracies, the government is run by lizard people. A cabal of high-level pedophilic Democrats operates out of a neighborhood pizza parlor, are insusceptible to the assurances of the mainstream media. Have we been misinformed at the power of misinformation? In 2006, more than 500 skeptics met at an Embassy Suites hotel near O'Hare Airport in Chicago to discuss conspiracy. They listened to presentations on mass hypnosis, the melting point of steel, and how to survive the collapse of the existing world order. They called themselves many things, including truth activists and 9/11 skeptics, although the name that would stick around and which observers would use for years after was truthers. The truthers held that the attacks on the Pentagon and the World Trade Center were masterminded by the White House to expand government power and enable military and security industries to profit from the war on terror. According to an explanation posted on 911truth.org, a group that helped sponsor the conference, George W. Bush and his allies gagged and intimidated whistleblowers, mailed anthrax to opponents in the Senate, and knowingly poisoned the inhabitants of Lower Manhattan. On that basis, truthers concluded, the administration does consider the lives of American citizens to be expendable on behalf of certain interests. The truthers, in short, maintained that the government had gone to extreme measures, including killing thousands of its own citizens, in order to carry out and cover up a conspiracy. And yet the same truthers advertised the conference online and met in a place where they could easily be surveilled. Speakers' names were posted on the internet, along with videos, photographs, and short bios. The organizers created a publicly accessible forum to discuss next steps, and a couple of attendees spoke to a reporter from the Times. Despite the mainstream media's ostensible complicity in the cover-up, by the logic of their own theories, the truthers were setting themselves up for an assassination. Their belief demonstrates a paradox of belief. Action is supposed to follow disbelief, and yet beliefs, even fervently espoused ones, sometimes exist in their own cognitive cage with little influence over behavior. Take the Pizzagate story, in which Hillary Clinton and her allies ran a child sex ring from the basement of a DC pizzeria. In the months surrounding the 2016 presidential election, a staggering number of Americans, millions by some estimates, endorsed the account, and in December of that year, a North Carolina man charged into the restaurant carrying an assault rifle. Vanderlinden and Berensky both used the incident as evidence of misinformation's violent implications, but they're missing the point. What's really striking is how anomalous that act was. The pizzeria received menacing phone calls, even death threats, but the most common response from believers, aside from liking posts, seemed to have been leaving negative Yelp reviews. That certain deeply held beliefs seem insulated from other interferences isn't particular to conspiracy theories. It's the experience of regular churchgoers. Catholics maintain that the sacrament is the body of Christ, yet no one expects the bread to taste like raw flesh or accuses fellow parishioners of cannibalism. In How God Becomes Real, 2020, the Stanford anthropologist T.M. Lehrman recounts evangelical Christians' frustrations with their own beliefs. They thought less about God when they were not in church. They confessed to not praying. I remember a man weeping in front of a church over not having sufficient faith that God would replace the job he had lost, Lehrman writes. The paradox of belief is one of Christianity's clearest messages, she observes. You must think you believe in God, but really you don't. You don't take God seriously enough. You don't act as if he's there. It's right out of Mark 9:24. Lord, I believe. Help my unbelief. The paradox of belief has been the subject of scholarly investigation. Puzzling it out promises new insights about the human psyche. Some of the most influential work has been seen by the French philosopher and cognitive scientist Dan Sperber. Born into a Jewish family in France in 1942 during the Nazi occupation, Sperber was smuggled to Switzerland when he was 3 months old. His parents returned to France 3 years later and raised him as an atheist while imparting a respect for all religious-minded people, including his Hasidic Jewish ancestors. The exercise of finding rationality in the seemingly irrational became an academic focus for Spurrier in the 1970s. Staying with the Dorz people in southern Ethiopia, he noticed that they made assertions that they seemed to believe and not to believe. People told him, for example, that the leopard is a Christian animal who observes the fasts of the Ethiopian Orthodox Church. Nevertheless, the average Dorz man guarded his livestock on fast days just as much as he did on other days. Not because he suspects some lepers of being bad Christians, Sperber wrote, but because he takes it as true, both that the leopards fast and that they are always dangerous. Sperber concluded that there are two kinds of beliefs. The first he has called factual beliefs. Factual beliefs, such as the belief that chairs exist and that leopards are dangerous, guide behavior and tolerate little inconsistencies. You can't believe that leopards do and do not eat livestock. The second category is called symbolic beliefs. These beliefs might feel genuine, but they're not cordoned off from action and expectation. We are, in turn, much more accepting of inconsistencies when it comes to symbolic beliefs. We can believe, say, that God is all-powerful and good while allowing for the existence of evil and suffering. In a masterly new book, Religion as Make-Believe, Harvard, Neil Van Leeuwen, a philosopher at Georgia State University, returns to Sperber's ideas with notable rigor. He analyzes beliefs with a taxonomous care, classifying different types and identifying the properties that distinguish them. He proposes that humans represent and use factual beliefs differently from symbolic beliefs, which he terms credences. Factual beliefs are for modeling reality and behaving optimally within it. Because of their function and guiding actions, they exhibit features like involuntariness. You can't decide to adopt them. And eventual vulnerability. They respond to evidence. Symbolic beliefs, meanwhile, largely serve social ends, not episiastic ones, so we can hold them even in the face of contradictory evidence. One of Van Leeuwen's insights is that people distinguish between different categories of belief and everyday speech. We say we believe symbolic ones, but that we think factual ones are true. He has run ingenious experiments showing that you can manipulate how people talk about beliefs by changing the environment in which they're expressed or sustained. Tell participants that a woman named Sheila set up a shrine to Elvis Presley and she plays songs on his birthday, and they will more often say that she believes Elvis is alive. But tell them that Sheila went to study penguins in Antarctica in 1977 and missed the news of his death, and they'll say she thinks he's still around. As the German sociologist George Simmel recognized more than a century ago, religious beliefs seem to express commitments. We believe in God the way we believe in a parent or a loved one, rather the way we believe chairs exist. Perhaps people who traffic in outlandish conspiracies don't so much believe them as they believe in them. Van Leeuwen's book complements a 2020 volume by Hugo Mercier, Not Born Yesterday. Mercier, a cognitive scientist at the École Normale Supérieure, who studied under Sperber, argues that worries about human gullibility overlook how skilled we are at acquiring factual beliefs. Our understanding of reality matters, he notes. Get it wrong and the consequences could be disastrous. On top of that, people have a selfish interest in manipulating one another. As a result, human beings have evolved a toolkit of psychological adaptations for evaluating information, what he calls open vigilance mechanisms. Where credulity theorists like Thagard insist that humans tend to believe anything, Mercier shows that we are careful when adopting factual beliefs and instinctively assess the quality of information, especially by tracking the reliability of sources. Van Leeuwen and Mercier agree that many beliefs are not best interpreted as factual ones, although they lay out different reasons for why this might be. For Van Leeuwen, major driver is group identity. Beliefs often function as badges, the stranger and more unsubstantiated the better. Religions, he notes, define membership on the basis of unverifiable and even unintelligible beliefs. That there is one God, that there is reincarnation, that this or this person was a prophet, and that the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit are separate yet one. And that's all we have time for today. By Manveer Singh, an assistant professor of anthropology at the University of California, Davis, who is at work on a new book about shamanism. We are at the conclusion of this week's The New Yorker Magazine program. This is your volunteer, Sun Sounds of Arizona volunteer broadcaster, Cicely Tiernan. Thank you for tuning in this week, and I invite you to join me next week for another new edition of The New Yorker Magazine. Have a great week and stay tuned to Sun Sounds of Arizona.